everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and it's time for It's All About Food. Thank you so much for being here with me today. I am back in Northern California. We tend to jump over to the West Side from time to time, and I have some projects going on. It's an interesting time to be here. There are a lot of wildfires going on, and I know people that are frantically evacuating and leaving their homes. And I haven't gotten a whiff of the smoke yet, but other people around me have. So it's an interesting time. We're going to talk about the weather a little more later on in the program, because it's not just about conversation anymore, talking about the weather. It's a serious conversation. I wanted to let you know, do you remember a couple of weeks ago, I interviewed Dr. Pedram Shojai? It was a fantastic show. If you haven't heard it, I hope you come back to the archives, either at prn.fm, or you can find it on my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com. And we talked about his documentary, Prosperity. Well, it is now available to watch for free, and it's fantastic. It's inspiring, and who doesn't need a little inspiration right now? And if you remember, we talked about how it is possible to do things that are good for the environment that are also profitable. So I hope you check out responsibleeatingandliving.com. It's right there on the homepage. You can click to see the film Prosperity Now. And when you register, there are lots of other opportunities to get involved with Dr. Shojai has an event called The Roadmap to Prosperity, and you'll learn all about that too. Okay? Fantastic. All right, now on to my guest for today is Glenn Merzer. He is an author, playwright, and screenwriter, and he grew up not far from where I grew up, in Belmore, New York on Long Island, attended college at New College of Florida in Sarasota, and after college, he became a stand-up comic in San Francisco around the 1980s, and worked with comics like Dana Carvey, A. Whitney Brown, and Will Durst. And then he attended two graduate schools in theater and didn't get a degree in either place. He ended up getting a graduate degree in creative writing in the creative writing program at Boston University, studying under Leslie Epstein. And he's written a number of books. We're going to be talking about them today. His first novel is called Off the Reservation, and it's a comic narrative about a quirky vegan congressman from Bloomington, Indiana, who undertakes an unconventional quest for the presidency. And then you're probably familiar with a lot of other books that he co-authored, including Howard Lyman's Mad Cowboy and No More Bull. We had Chef AJ on the show to talk about her book, Unprocessed, and Merzer is a co-author of that book. We had Dr. Pam Popper on the show to talk about food over medicine, and Merzer is a co-author. And we've had Del Sruth on many times to talk about a number of his cookbooks. And Better Than Vegan is also co-authored by Glenn Merzer. And The Plant Advantage with Benji Kurtz. Okay, so I think we're gonna have a lot of things to talk about that are seemingly food related. Glenn, welcome. How are you?
Fine, Karen. How are you?
Well, you know what? I'm going to be honest. I have a little cold.
Ah.
And, you know, we vegans like to think that we're super people. We don't get cold. But I know what I did. And I'm working to get better really quickly. This last month has been really challenging. My 89-year-old father is having some health challenges. I've been taking him to all kinds of appointments and procedures. And as a result, I end up working late at night to catch up on my own work. And then we got on an airplane, which is probably the worst thing you can do when you're run down, because it kicks you further down. And then I got a call.
Yeah, air travel can be bad even for vegans.
Yep,
But yep. We do bounce back faster than the meat eaters, I find.
That's my plan. Bouncing. Yeah. Bouncing back. Anyway, it was great to meet you. What was it? Just a few months ago, right?
Yes, it was in July.
Yeah. At one of my favorite restaurants out here in the Bay Area, the Vegetarian House. Although I don't know that you loved it as much as we do. It wasn't quite as clean as you would have liked it to be.
Well, it was a nice restaurant. It was a big menu, and it was fine. It was a little harder to avoid oil than
yep.
I like, but that's not unusual in vegetarian restaurants.
No, in fact, I think that was part of what knocked me down this past weekend, because we landed and an old friend of mine hosted us for a few days, and he's really been wonderful. He wanted to cook vegan food and do all kinds of things. And as a result, there was a lot of oil slipping
yeah.
around.
yeah.
And you have to decide, am I going to really split hairs here, or am I going to accept the gifts and offerings that people are sharing with me?
Right.
You know, I'll stop it. I won't eat an animal. You know, if somebody prepares
right.
something that isn't vegan, I'm not eating it. But if it has a little oil, oh, well.
Yeah.
Oh, well. Okay, Glenn. You wrote this book a couple of years ago, Off the Reservation, and I did read it as soon as I came home, once you gave it to me.
Thank you.
I enjoyed it very much, and even though we're not living with a administration today that is progressive and we don't have any vegan politicians in the top offices, I found that there were some really prescient things that went on during the election in your book that related to what we went on in our recent election in late 2016.
Okay, and what are you specifically referring to?
Well, you know, I haven't read it in a while, so I'm like, I remember that, and I'm trying to remember the details. But
one thing that was similar was that my candidate, Evan Gorgoni, the vegan congressman from Bloomington, Indiana, his campaign manager says to him, "We don't want you to be corrupt, so we're going to limit donations to $20. And so he runs
That's
a
right.
campaign where he's funded on just $20 donations. And as it turned out, Bernie Sanders ran a campaign. He didn't limit it to $20 by any means, but his average contribution was something like
$29. That's right.
And you can raise tens of millions of dollars that way if you get enough donations.
Yep, I think that was the one that really tickled me. How did you know that? How did you know that was something like that was going to happen?
I don't know that. Maybe Bernie read the book. I don't know. But, you know, if you do the math and you get 2 million $20 donations, you got $40 million bucks.
The other thing that I liked, and that was somewhat similar, but actually turned out to be drastically different and detrimental, was you pointed out that everyone was hungry for a change and hungry for a politician to speak his mind.
Right.
And your character did just that. He didn't want to run. He just spoke the truth. And then
right.
everybody wanted him because he was saying what people wanted to hear. And we thought, well, some people thought that was happening in November 2016.
Right.
With the current man who is in office. I can't even say
right.
his name.
Right.
But he was a liar.
Yeah, well, my candidate didn't use teleprompters. And in the novel, he gives his nomination acceptance speech without a teleprompter. And I think what attracted a lot of voters to Trump, I hope you don't mind if I say his name.
No.
Well, I think what attracted a lot of voters to him was that in their minds, there was a kind of authenticity to his just going up to microphones and saying what was ever on his mind. You know, he's a kind of authentic fraud and authentic con man, but he's
yeah.
authentic. So my guy's a lot a lot better human being than the current president, but there was that same quality of you didn't know what my candidate would say next, and you didn't know what Trump would say next.
Maybe Trump read your book, too.
I don't think Trump has read a book in his life.
Yeah, there is that question of whether he really can read.
I don't think he read The Art of the Deal that he allegedly wrote.
I just
don't think the man can read, you know, more than a page or two.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, let's back up a little bit to you.
Okay.
So you have a kind of a colorful past where you were a stand-up comic. You grew up near I did. When did being a vegetarian kick in?
I became a vegetarian as a teenager. I was listening to Dick Gregory, who passed away recently.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about the vegetarian diet, and I had two uncles. One was in his 40s and one was in his 50s, and they died of heart attacks when I was a teenager. And they were my mother's two brothers. And on my father's side of the family, all the men seemed to die at age 56. And my mother, who was then, let's see, about 50 or 52, she was getting heart pains, angina. Mm. And she would walk up seven steps to the kitchen. She was maybe a few pounds overweight, but not much, you know, maybe 5 or 10 pounds overweight. She would walk up the steps to the kitchen, and she would grab her heart and have terrible heart pains. And I just watched everybody dying around me like flies and my mother having pains, and I said, this is crazy. We got to stop eating meat. So I decided that I would stop eating meat after my last day of high school of my junior year, so starting that summer. So the first day of summer vacation, I got up in the morning, and I made myself an English muffin for breakfast, and I put some jam on it. And then the phone rang, and it was my old buddy Dave, who I grew up with, and I said, "Hey, Dave, congratulate me. I became a vegetarian." And he said, "Well, that's great. Since when?" And I said, "Well, you know, since breakfast." And he laughed at me, and because he laughed at me, I think I was resolved, so I haven't had any meat since then. So I think it was helpful to be laughed at right away. And so that was now, what, 44 years ago or so that I stopped eating meat.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. I stopped eating meat when I was 15, and that was 44 years ago.
There you go. Same year.
Something must have been in that Long Island water.
Yeah. And then, unfortunately, I kept eating dairy because I got, you know, people told me, "Oh, where do you get your protein?" So I said, "Well, cheese." You know. So I unfortunately kept eating dairy till I was about 33 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what caused it, but at around that age, I was starting to feel sometimes like an electrical shock. I would suddenly feel this electrical shock near my heart, and I didn't know what the hell it was, and I still don't know what the hell it was, but it happened to me 4 or 5 times, and I said, "I'm eating cheese. It's what Howard Lyman calls liquid meat. You know, it's crazy. Why am I eating, you know, dairy products that are also high in fat and saturated fat and cholesterol?" So I gave it up, and I never had that sensation since then. So I think that maybe my bad family genes for high cholesterol, combined with the fact that I was still eating dairy, were, you know, I was starting to damage myself already, even on a vegetarian diet.
Yep, we can do that. I was right there with you. I didn't give up dairy until I was 30.
Yeah.
And I know it took its toll.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned protein, and people, unfortunately, are still talking about protein. And I don't know if you saw it. I read the New York Times, and about a week ago, Jane Brody wrote an article. And I've never liked what Jane Brody has to say, because she always seems to be way behind
right.
the current nutritional information. She has an article called Good Vegan, Bad Vegan.
Mm-hmm.
And she's kind of reviewing the documentary What the Health.
Mm-hmm.
And she's taking the side that a lot of the information that are that's presented as facts are a little bit sensational and not true. And then she goes further. She says, you know, she doesn't endorse the inhumane treatment of farm animals and the wanton pollution of the environment with animal waste and misused antibiotics and pesticides. I'm reading it right out of the article.
Right.
Of course, it's okay for her to eat them. She thinks that's that can be humane. But at the bottom of the article, this is where I started like pulling my hair out, because she repeated this ancient information that was debunked in the 80s, and that has to do with plant foods not having complete protein.
Oh, boy, she's behind the times.
So behind the times. So, folks, you've probably heard this before, but back in the 70s, Francis Moore LePay wrote the book Diet for a Small Planet. It was a fantastic book. I love the granola recipe in there. I still have my original copy, and it's all like falling apart and ripped to shreds. And she was putting together the fact that all this plant food was used to feed animals, and we could feed so many more people, all of the hungry people, if we weren't eating meat. But she mentioned in the book, because she looked around all around the world and said that plant foods can be nutritious if we combine them properly, because there are 8 or 9 essential amino acids, the building blocks of protein that we don't have in our bodies that we need to get to make the proteins that we need. So we need to get them from food. And all plants have all of them. Some plants have them in different ratios than others. So it is important to eat a diverse selection of food, but that's true on any diet. And so she was talking about combining beans and rice in Mexico and other legumes and grains in other places, and that's how you get complete protein. But Frances Moore LePay came out in her revised edition 10 years later and said, oops, I was wrong. The body's smart. You don't have to eat the exact ratios of everything in one sitting. Your body knows how to manage it and store it and put it together when it needs it. Do you want to add anything to that, Glenn?
Well, that's, of course, absolutely right. And it's just silly. I mean, who do we know who's in a hospital today because they have they're vegans and they didn't get enough protein, or they're vegans and they got proteins in the wrong ratio? There's nobody in the hospital in America today. We got, 320 million people? There isn't one person in one hospital in America today who has that problem. But we have hospitals full of people with heart attacks and full of people with, you know, diseases caused by the meat-based diet. So it's just imagining a problem that doesn't exist.
How is it that she's still working for the New York Times?
That I won't get into. But, you know,
why not?
You know, there are these, you know, Michael Pollan is another example of these seemingly sensible, moderate reporters who yes, they don't like the confined animal feeding operations, and they recognize that people are eating too much flesh, but they can't quite come to the simple basic truth that human beings are herbivores, that everything about the way our bodies are designed makes us herbivores, and that there's absolutely no need for any animal flesh in the human diet. There's no need, obviously, for any bovine lactation in the human diet. There's no need to eat any eggs. There's no need for any of it. And people like you and me who are eating none of it are in good health and not suffering from any protein deficiencies. So, you know, to them, it's just too extreme to endorse the vegan diet, the plant-based diet. But in fact, there's nothing extreme about eating the way the body was designed. Our closest cousins are the primates, and they are essentially herbivores. As I mentioned, there's a talk I did that people can find on YouTube if they type in my name, a talk I gave at the WGA, but I point out in that talk that chimpanzees are about 95 to 98% herbivores, but they apparently occasionally the male chimps will trap a monkey in the trees and break its neck and take the flesh and give that flesh to female chimpanzees to eat in exchange for sex. And as I point out in the talk, that is just appalling behavior. But they're not doing it for nutritional reasons. They're doing it to get laid, you know. So other than that, our primate cousins are herbivores.
Well, maybe there are some dots connected there where human men think they need to eat meat because they'll get laid.
Maybe.
Somehow. They don't, and they're not sharing it. They're just eating it themselves. Who knows? Oh, that's a crazy world.
So, you know, apparently people like the taste of flesh, you know? Mm-hmm. And there is a, there's probably an evolutionary incentive for people to like the taste of fat. Because originally the great struggle of our ancestors was not to live to 100 to try to stay in great health and have a long a vibrant life until 100. They were trying, you know, the imperative was to live to 25 and procreate. So our ancestors didn't have to worry so much about heart disease. They had to worry about getting enough calories. And fat has more calories than carbohydrate or protein. So, you know, it's possible that there was an evolutionary incentive to like the taste of fat. Nuts and seeds are fatty and give you a lot of calories, so there was an incentive to like the taste of nuts and seeds. And to the extent, which is, I think, overrated, that our ancestors ate flesh, they were motivated to like the taste of flesh. There's a lot of calories in it. You know, today our problem isn't that we need, that the American people need more calories. We have a very, very rich diet, and that's what happens when you're getting too much fat instead of not enough fiber and complex carbohydrates in your diet.
I was talking with Dr. Joel Fuhrman last week because he has a new book out called Fast Food Genocide, and I brought this up on the show last week, but I'm still kind of amazed by it, how nature works. And he was talking about animals in nature and how when they have a rich diet where a predator, for example, is eating up the population of its prey, nature kicks in, and they're not able to procreate in great numbers for two or three generations. It's not just one generation.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're seeing all kinds of repercussions that nature is kicking in right now. And some of it may be linked just to trim the population.
Well, you know, the reality is that, you know, people procreate in mostly in their 20s and 30s, a little bit in their 40s, and the diseases that our Western diet is causing tends to kill people in their 50s and 60s and 70s, and also even if it doesn't kill them, it you know, things like strokes reduce your quality of life. Mm-hmm. And so the problem is that, you know, heart disease tends to afflict people in middle age after they've already procreated. So it's not that it's going to trim the population. It's that it's going to ruin people's lives, shorten people's lives, and escalate healthcare costs. And, you know, what gets me, and I'm a regular watcher of MSNBC, and I'm a fan of Rachel Maddow and Lawrence O'Donnell, but all of these progressive hosts on MSNBC, whenever they discuss the issue of health insurance and Obamacare, they never mention the fact that we are the fattest, sickest population ever to walk the face of the earth. You know, and it's just amazing how much political dialogue I've listened to for this, ever since Obama did Obamacare, without anybody imagining, seemingly on the airwaves, that we have a bigger problem than health insurance. We have a health crisis, not a health insurance crisis. And you know, all they talk about is who should pay the bill, and they're never addressing the fact that we're the fattest, sickest population ever to walk the earth.
My dad has a lot of expressions, and one of my favorites is, if you can't solve the problem, eliminate the problem. And it applies beautifully to just what we're talking about. So we have all of these tremendous costs, and we can't figure out how to insure people fairly and properly, but we're not talking, like you said, of eliminating the problem. People shouldn't be sick. And I like to go even further and say, if everybody was eating well and living a long quality life and wasn't dying and falling prey to heart disease and diabetes and cancer and all the chronic diseases that are out there today, our medical professionals and research scientists could actually work on the challenging diseases that we don't know much about.
Yeah.
The things that really plague us that aren't affecting many people, fortunately, but wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah. And we need more doctors who who understand nutrition. We have so few doctors who understand nutrition. You know, the average medical education includes less than an hour of nutritional studies, which is just insane. It reinforces in the young doctor's mind the idea that, well, nutrition couldn't be terribly important. They don't tell us anything about it. So doctors are literally ignorant about literally the first thing about health, which is that the thing that will affect your health outcomes more than anything else is the food you eat. You know, unless you're also, you know, chain smoking, then that will affect your health the most. Or if you're, you know, a heroin addict, then that will affect your health the most. But in general, it's diet that's going to have the most effect on your health. And doctors literally know nothing about it and don't make it a part of their practice. I'd like to tell you about a friend of mine, Dr. Stephen Luenda, in the Los Angeles area, who shared his story with me that when he went to medical school, he never learned anything about nutrition. It just wasn't part of the curriculum. And he himself was overweight. He was 80, 90 pounds overweight. And he started practicing at Kaiser in the L.A. area. And he found that for the first 8 years he was in practice, he hardly helped anyone. I mean, he's a very intelligent guy, very nice guy, very caring guy, and he kept up to speed on, you know, the medications he was supposed to dispense. And so he would give people their metformin for their type 2 diabetes or whatever drugs he was supposed to administer, and he would monitor the dosages and do the best he could to take care of everybody, and he never helped a soul. Perhaps he exaggerates when he says that, but he found that he was not helping anyone, and they were getting sicker and just changing their medications and dying sometimes. And he felt terrible, and he was also very worried about his own health. And then he listened to an audio tape of a Joel Fuhrman book, as it happens. You just mentioned Joel Fuhrman. But he became acquainted with plant-based nutrition And his first reaction was, gee, this couldn't possibly be true, or somebody would have told me about it. but he himself went on a plant-based diet, and he lost 80 or 90 pounds. And now, when patients come to him for their type 2 diabetes or their obesity or their autoimmune disease or their heart disease, he's a family practitioner, when they come to him for a variety of problems, he begins by talking to them about diet, and he gets his patients to adopt the correct diet, and now he helps everyone, you know, or at least everyone who's willing to listen to him and change their diet. And he's become so, well-known in his area that he started to give classes in the evenings at Kaiser, and he's got a waiting list of people to come and hear, because people have started to say, holy cow, there's actually a doctor in town who helps people, you know? And so
I was going to say, the story is a little like Dr. John McDougall. He talks about that in the beginning of his practice. He wasn't making anybody well either.
Yeah. And all of our hearts go out to him now, because I heard that he lost his home in the fire yesterday.
Oh, my goodness. I was wondering about him, and I was wondering about True North Health Center, which is in Santa Rosa as well.
Right. I heard that True North had a little smoke damage, but not bad. But Dr. McDougall lost
his
house.
Yeah.
He's okay, but he lost his
house.
So, you know.
Well, let's talk about the weather.
Yes.
Let's talk about the weather. So, are you in Southern California at the moment?
I'm in Southern California.
Yeah. No smoke there where you are?
Well, Anaheim had bad fires, but we're not smelling the smoke here. I'm in the San Fernando Valley. But, you know, Howard Lyman and I wrote about this in Mad Cowboy 20 years ago, that as we do more and more animal agriculture, one of the effects on the climate will be to dry the climate and cause more fires. And it's not the only reason this is happening to the climate, but it's a major one. We're reaping the whirlwind of animal agriculture.
Yes, we are. And, we don't want to sit here and say, I told you so. It's devastating. And so many people are experiencing losing their home. And there's a few people that have already died because of the fires. And we see it all around, these kinds of repercussions all over the world. We've had one after another of the hurricanes in Florida and all up the eastern coast, Puerto Rico. It's continually in the news. And floods. It's all intensifying. And where are the cause?
Yeah.
Well, do you think anybody will... I don't know. I don't like to be full of gloom and doom. I always like to stay optimistic. You know, the sixth great extinction may be upon us. But in the meanwhile, I think we should do the best we can. Stay healthy, enjoy our lives, live as long as we can, feeling good, and eat delicious food. And maybe turn things around.
Well, what we also have to do politically is redefine what is progressive. You know, Bernie Sanders' definition of what is progressive seems to be, let's have Medicare for all, and let's just send everyone to the doctor. Whenever I hear on MSNBC or hear progressive political candidates talking about the climate, they talk about fossil fuels and, you know, how we have to make the transition from coal and natural gas to and oil to solar and wind. Well, I agree with him. We do have to transition from coal to solar, absolutely. But that's, you can't just pick your favorite greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide, and imagine that that's the whole problem. Methane is variously estimated at being 30 to 80 times more potent a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And methane comes out of both ends of a cow. So you can't just, you know, wish that away. It's the leading cause of climate change. The leading cause of climate change by a country mile is animal agriculture. It is, according to a UN report, animal agriculture contributes more greenhouse gases than all forms of transportation combined. According to a World Watch report, they said, no, the UN report undersold it. It's actually 51% of greenhouse gases caused by animal agriculture. So it is far and away the leading cause of climate change is hamburger, on top of which, you know, it's hard to factor in that they're chopping down the Amazon for hamburger. And how much does chopping down the Amazon, in addition to causing a whole host of other problems, how much does that add to climate change? You have to factor in all the carbon dioxide capture and oxygen production that you're losing. It's hard to do the math. But chopping back rainforests for hamburger while you're adding so much methane into the atmosphere by having a billion cows, this is what's drying the planet and causing the heating up of the planet and causing these violent weather events that we're having. And so we have to redefine what is progressive. What is progressive is not trying to send everybody to the doctor for free. What is progressive is getting to the root cause of climate change and the root cause of sickness. And it's the same thing. It's animal agriculture. So we have to, we need to have politicians who are brave enough to speak out against animal agriculture. And on health policy, we have to have politicians who are brave enough to say, you know, the solution isn't going to be sending everyone to the doctor for free. The solution is going to be making us a healthier population by eating human food instead of eating meat three times a day. We're not carnivores, and not even carnivores like the lion eat meat three times a day. So it's insane. Nor does the lion eat cheese, you know?
I agree with you that animal agriculture is a very significant contributor to climate change and all other kinds of environmental degradation. But I think it's a symptom of something that's very human, and that is we will exploit at any cost if we can profit from it. And I'd like to see somehow that as we evolve, if we're on this planet long enough, that we can evolve past that and kind of include in our own personal missions to do good, to be kind, and not exploit.
I absolutely agree with you. That's a healthier set of values for humanity. But within the confines of the fact that we have a capitalist economy, we can, with political will, change things so that positive end results can come. For example, the government subsidizes animal agriculture. We give $100 billion a year in subsidies, farm subsidies, and almost all of that goes to animal agriculture. So animal agriculture would not be sustainable if we weren't subsidizing it. So the political policy that we need to advocate is for either an end to all farm subsidies or for farm subsidies to be directed towards growing organic fruits and vegetables for human beings instead of growing crops to feed to cows, to waste tremendous amounts of water and produce tremendous amounts of methane gas and ruin the our lakes and streams with animal runoff and so forth. So, you know, we can, within a capitalist economy, motivate healthy actions and you know, a healthy use of resources. What we're doing now is, within a supposedly capitalist economy, we're giving socialist incentives to animal agriculture. We're subsidizing them. That has to end.
You just used a bad word, socialized, because the folks that really believe in those subsidies are very anti-socialism, except when it benefits them.
Except when it benefits them, of course.
Yeah. So we're seeing our Environmental Protection Agency lose regulations and funding to protect the environment, all in the name of reducing taxes. But still, we have we will see a big tax budget come out, and I don't think there'll be any mention about reducing subsidies to animal agriculture businesses or the businesses that make the toxic foods, the sugars, corn syrup, those, the things that don't make us healthy. Where are the subsidies for organic broccoli, everybody?
Yeah. The kind of Tea Party reactionaries who always get upset, you know, that the government is wasting tax dollars on whatever, public television or Planned Parenthood or whatever, but they're the first ones to vote for $100 billion a year in subsidies to animal agriculture. Not one of them votes against that spending, you know. So, you know, they tend to come from rural America, and they're all for government spending when it's for defense or when it's for animal agriculture, for anything that wastes tremendous amounts of resources and has a negative effect on the environment.
Okay, so the Glenn Mercer healthcare health insurance plan,
right,
the progressive healthcare health insurance plan, what would that look like?
Well, it starts from the premise that we don't have a health insurance crisis, we have a health crisis. Again, we're the fattest, sickest population ever to walk the earth, so what do we do about that? And the answer has to be that we change the food. So, of course, the first thing we should do, as I was saying, is end these farm subsidies that go to animal agriculture. But in terms of the payments to doctors, I don't believe that we're going to see anytime soon what Bernie Sanders and a number of progressives are proposing, which is Medicare for all. I don't, you know, I'm a progressive. I'm a left-wing Democrat. And so I don't have anything philosophically against Medicare for all or single payer. I know that it works in Canada and in Britain and in other parts of the world, and I'm not against it philosophically, but I actually think it would not work well in the United States at this time, because in the United States, not only are the people so terribly fat and sick, but in addition to that, we have doctors who overdiagnose and who run countless tests on people. So just imagine if everybody could go to the doctor 5 days a week for free for anything they want, and doctors can run whatever tests they want. I mean, my mother, when she was 90 years old, went to her doctor who suggested she have a preventive mammogram.
No,
at
please.
90 years old.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, it's insanity.
Yep.
So If we decide, oh, the government will just pick up the bill, and people can just go to the doctor, and the doctors can just, you know, be free to run any test they want. They often make money in their own offices doing all kinds of testing. and with just the sky's the limit with no restraints, there will be no money left for the Environmental Protection Agency. There will be no money left for education. There will be no money left for infrastructure. There will be no money left for any number of progressive goals. Everything will go to doing PSA tests and mammograms and DEXA scans and one unnecessary test after another on people who trust their doctors. The medical community should not be blindly trusted. We have an opioid crisis in this country. People are dying right and left of heroin addiction, which was initially started because they went to the doctor who gave them opioids for their back pain. Mm-hmm. So why are we trusting doctors? And why do we want to give all of our tax dollars to doctors? So I'm against single payer, not because philosophically I'm against government intervention in the market or something, but just because it won't work in America today and we can't afford it. So, and we also have a pretty major private health insurance industry in this country, and I just can't imagine, you know, how many people who currently work at health insurance companies would suddenly be out of a job. So what I would suggest is we do what the kind of thing that Obama was trying to do, which is to work within the confines of a private health insurance industry, but we allow underwriting back into the equation. Before Obamacare, health insurers would underwrite people, and sometimes they would say, "Oh, you're 100 pounds overweight. There's going to be a surcharge on your health care unless you enroll in this program to lose weight. Oh, you're a smoker? Well, you're going to pay more for your health insurance." And sometimes they would decline people, and people couldn't get a health insurance policy. Now, that was a moral outrage, that people could be declined. Let's say somebody had a job, and they were getting their health care through work. They lost their job, but they had a cancer diagnosis or they had kidney dialysis or something, and so the health insurance would decline them. And that was a moral outrage that Obama addressed with his law, that we call Obamacare. It was good of him to address that problem. It needed to be addressed. But there's an easier way to do it than the Rube Goldberg contraption that he put together for Obamacare. The simple answer should be, if you are declined by a private health insurer, the letter of declination goes immediately to two places, to the applicant and to Medicare. And so if you are declined a policy for health reasons, you should get a Medicare policy immediately. So in short, the government should insure the sick people who are being declined by the health insurers. Now, what that would do is it would immediately force the health insurance industry to lower the cost of premiums, because a very good provision of Obamacare was written by Senator Al Franken, and it requires that 80% of all health care premiums go to pay claims. So you know, Anthem and Blue Shield and Kaiser and these companies, they can't jack up premiums and just use it to pay themselves salaries. 80% of the money that comes in has to go to pay claims. So if you get the sickest people off the rolls of the health insurance carriers, you put them on Medicare, then the premiums will go down for everyone else. So that's the solution. Obama's solution to it was a Rube Goldberg contraption whereby he tries to force everybody to get health insurance or you pay a fine, and then he makes the young and the healthy overpay for their insurance in order to lower the rates for the older and sicker people. And then he's forcing the health insurance companies to do something illogical, which is to provide in a private market health insurance for people who are just terribly expensive. I mean, if I told you that an 80-year-old guy who is scheduled for a triple bypass and has a diagnosis of brain cancer, applies for life insurance, and he's declined, you wouldn't say to me, oh, that greedy life insurance company, why won't they give him a policy? You would almost laugh, right? You would almost laugh that he would even apply for life insurance. Well, it's the same thing. It's a private health insurance company. It's kind of crazy for them from an economic standpoint to have to give a policy to someone who they know is going to cost $1 million a year. So, but on the other hand, it's cruel not to let people have access to health care. So the answer is those people should immediately get Medicare policies and keep the sickest people on the public rolls, get them off the private companies' rolls, let the private companies then lower prices for everyone else, let them put underwriting back in the equation so they can motivate people to get healthy, to lose weight, to stop smoking. That was at least one good outcome from having a private health insurance system rather than public. So let that one positive side of having private health insurance back into the equation, and that would be the solution.
Mm. Is anybody promoting something like that?
I actually heard a former Republican congressman named David Jolly say something similar. I had put this on my blog a couple years ago, and my blog could be found at offthereservationnovel.com. But I heard David Jolly, former congressman from Florida, suggest a similar idea. But it seems to me that, such a simpler way to go about how to solve this problem. And the problem is, in a private system, why should a private company give health insurance to someone on kidney dialysis? It doesn't make sense. So Obama's solution is to force them to do it and then to raise the prices on the young and healthy. But, young and healthy people have enormous college debt that they have to pay. They have enormous struggles in this economy. Why should a young, healthy person have to pay $300 a month for health insurance that they're unlikely to use? So it's the wrong solution to try to make young, healthy people pay more in order to force the health insurance companies to insure, the older and sicker.
Well, I like it, Glenn. I like the plan. Now the question is, how do we make it happen? We've got a lot of things that we need to make happen, and right now, I'm just sticking with breathing to get through what's going on in our government right now.
Well, we have to make sure that number one, that progressives and Democrats get out to vote in 2018, because if we can take back the House, then we can stop the current administration from doing any legislative damage. There's other ways they could do damage, but we can stop them from doing any legislative damage. Certainly, Obamacare is a better alternative than anything the Republicans have put up. So I prefer Obamacare and the Democrats' position on this to the Republican position is just basically, let's have a tax cut for the rich and we'll take it out of health care. We're best off trying to keep in place what we have. But we have to realize that the ultimate problem isn't health insurance. The ultimate solution is to work on our own health, make ourselves healthy by eating human food. And we need to change the terms of the debate so that progressives, real progressives, people who understand that animal agriculture needs to be stopped or, curtailed as much as possible and should not be subsidized. We need to get people with that progressive view on the air, because as much as I like Rachel Maddow and Chris Hayes and Lawrence O'Donnell, you never hear anybody on their shows expressing this viewpoint that we need to... when they talk about climate change, they never talk about animal agriculture. When they talk about health care, they never talk about health. They never talk about the fact that we're such a sick society. I actually heard there's a delightful woman named Anna Marie Cox, who is sometimes a guest on these shows, particularly Lawrence O'Donnell. And I tend to like the woman and often agree with her. But I actually heard her say were discussing Obamacare, saying what a tragedy it would be to lose Obamacare just and people's access to doctors just when we're in an opioid crisis. And I'm thinking, who does she think caused the opioid crisis?
She's not thinking.
Yeah, doctors caused the opioid crisis, and you know what they call iatrogenic death, death by doctor and the medical system, is the third leading cause of death in America. It's variously estimated. Johns Hopkins did a study estimating it at between 250,000 and 400,000 deaths per year. That's
Glenn. We have a minute left.
Okay.
And I know that you can go on talking about all of this for a really long time, as I could. We're very passionate about this, but it's been a very informative hour, and I really appreciate you sharing everything. Can you tell me again the website where your blog is?
Offthereservationnovel.com. And by the way, the novel Off the Reservation just this week, for those who are listening live, has a Kindle sale of just 99 cents for the Kindle version on Amazon. So just go to Amazon and type in Off the Reservation, and the Kindle version is just 99 cents this week.
Good. It's a fun read. I recommend it. Glenn, thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food.
Thank you, Karen.
Okay, be well. Yeah, so we just have 30 seconds left, and as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, I want to remind you, go to responsibleeatingandliving.com, and you can register for the Prosperity documentary where you can watch it for a limited time for free if you need inspiration and want to hear about some wonderful projects going on. This is a great film, and I hope you watch it. That's it. I'm Karen Hartgless. You've been listening to another episode of It's All About Food. My guest was Gan Mercer, and have a delicious week.